Thanks for listening. This is episode 6 of The Minimal Pair. I'm Jean Dempsey, and this is Stephanie X.
Hi, everybody.
Hi, Stephanie. How are you?
I'm doing okay. How about you, Jean?
Pretty good, considering how quickly finals are approaching. I'm holding in there.
Yeah, they're getting here quickly, a lot more quickly than I'm comfortable with, to be honest.
Yeah, so this is obviously a stressful time of year, so for tonight's topics in language learning, we've decided to talk about taking care of ourselves as teachers. Very pertinent topic, I think.
I think so. And I think it's applicable, you know, whether you're teaching in a higher education situation or in a language institute type of situation. I think it's a good idea to sometimes like sit back, take stock in like what's going on with you and how you're doing mentally, emotionally, and, you know, in terms of taking care of yourself. So, yeah, we definitely want to talk a little bit about how we can do that as teachers.
Unfortunately, we were not able to attend the TESOL presentation called Keeping ESL Teachers from Becoming Their Own Worst Enemies, because I feel like had one of us gone to that, we would have had some interesting things to contribute. But that was definitely the inspiration, I think, for doing this episode.
Yeah, between that and then recently I read a blog post by Stack of Marking. The blog post was titled Balance, and it was Thomas Starkey is the author of the blog. And in seeing his post on balance, that mixed with the session that you and I had talked about during our trip to Portland, it really did get me thinking about ways that I could take care of myself, or maybe ways that I already am taking care of myself. So,
well, I look forward to hearing your tips, because I am not doing very much to take care of myself, I don't feel like. So why don't you share some of the tips that you came up with?
Okay, sure. And I just want to put it out there, I'm not an authority on taking care of yourself. If you meet me, you'll probably realize that, because I can be very scattered at times. But these are just kind of some things that have come to mind for me personally. So let's just kind of do a countdown. You know, number 5, exercise. I mean, I think that that's pretty straightforward, and I know it's one that everybody, you know, hears about in terms of managing stress. But I really think getting outside, getting some fresh air, and exercising, even if it's just for 10 minutes, can really do a lot of good.
I agree. I feel like in the past, I've been a lot better about it, and I can feel the difference this semester. I used to make a point of walking my dog every day, and this semester I haven't been so good about that, and I think part of it has been the weather that we've been cursed with in St. Louis this winter. But I can feel the difference, and it's kind of a catch-22, because not exercising makes me feel less energetic, and then that makes me want to not exercise. So simple but good advice, I think.
Absolutely. And by the way, Jean, you still owe me a racquetball game.
I do. I need to find my racket.
So we gotta get on that. But yeah, I mean, the endorphins are great. It kind of is nice even just to like step away for a minute, even if you're not exercising, if you're just getting a little bit, sitting outside on your front porch, getting some fresh air, that can be really helpful. So yeah, I'm a fan of that. So number 4, doing our backwards countdown here, or countdown, quiet time. So, you know, as teachers, we are constantly either talking or having somebody talk to us. And, you know, as an introvert, somebody who's an introvert, you know, sometimes that can be really overwhelming. And for me, I like to take a little bit of time each day where it's not, you know, I'm not overwhelmed by people asking me questions. I mean, I have 2 young children too, so it's really important for me to have a little bit of time where it's just completely quiet.
Yeah, I don't know how you do it. Having students and kids seems like a pretty lethal combination to me, but... but I agree. I actually, for the first time in a while, turned the radio off in my car. And when I was driving over here this evening to record, I drove in silence, and it was very refreshing. And I think that quiet time is something for me that I usually combine with exercise, because I'm not one of those people who has to have music while I'm exercising. I'll usually go for a walk and it'll be completely silent. So I've been missing out on both, but it was very nice to drive over here in complete silence.
It can be nice. And, you know, introverts really have to take care of themselves if they're teachers, because, you know, we don't, not to speak for all introverts everywhere, but, you know, it can really feel exhausting. You know, we don't get our energy from talking with people, like maybe extroverts do. We get our energy from that alone time. And so to really be fresh and awake and alive in front of the class, sometimes that quiet time is just necessary. So yeah. Now, number three. This is a huge one for me. And it's one that I'm constantly balancing and trying to work with. And I'm not always that great at it. But it's setting boundaries with students.
And believe it or not, this was an issue while we were planning. Stephanie was getting text messages from a student who needed help. So I think it's great to make yourself available. And I do the same. I definitely have given my cell phone number to students. And it has been a bit of an issue. I had students text me this semester asking if we had a snow day when they could have found that information elsewhere very easily. So what are some ideas you have for drawing boundaries with students yet not making it seem like you're not accessible?
Well, I let them know. I do provide my cell phone number, and I don't know if I'll always do this or not. Most of the time, students are respectful. But, you know, like tonight, the student texting me like nonstop about a class that I'm not even teaching. You know, she has questions about a different class. And so that to me is just kind of like outside the bounds, and I'll talk with her about that. But, you know, I will ask them to first try email. And if they don't hear from me right away, or if it is an emergency, go ahead and send me a text. I can answer your question. But I try to set the expectation of, just because you send the text, it doesn't mean that I've read it right away or that I'm in a place to respond. And a lot of times if I say like, oh, I may be driving and you send me a text, I'm not going to respond to you while I'm driving.
That's a good way to get in a car accident.
It is a good way to get in a car accident. It happens fairly frequently, I hear. So anyway, so I do that. That's one thing that I do. Is there anything that you do to set expectations or boundaries with students?
Well, I also try to let them know that their first line of communication needs to be email. Mm-hmm. That they cannot, that I try to explain to them that I'm teaching this many classes and I have this many students in each class, and take a moment and imagine if every one of those students texted me with some question and how overwhelming that would be. So I try to put it in perspective for them. That it's really much better if they email me. And it's funny because I have those students who will text me when it's not an emergency at all, and then I'll have students who will completely drop off the face of the earth and not send me a text at all. So right. I would love some kind of happy medium. But I think it's just important to make the boundaries clear with students as far as texting is concerned.
Absolutely. And you know, another area where I have to set boundaries, and I've learned this in the last week or so, is with, you know, when they have to turn things in. And so this might be like while they're in class working on a test and they're trying to just push, even though class is over, they're thinking, oh, I can work on this 5 more minutes or 10 more minutes. But what my students, I'm sure they don't realize, I'm sure they're not trying to be rude, but what happens is that, you know, I have a class that ends at 10:45 and next class begins at 11. And sometimes I have to make copies, or sometimes I have to go to the bathroom.
Or have 15 minutes of quiet
or
time.
Or just chill out for a second. But, you know, last week I had somebody just like pushing me. And I didn't get that time that I really needed between classes. And so the next class I said, you know, I don't care what you're doing at 10:45. If I don't have your paper, I'm leaving and I won't take it. And I didn't say it rudely, but I let them know like, hey, you can't just like abuse my time. You know, I respect your time by coming to class on time and ending class on time. Please respect mine as well.
Yeah, I've definitely had a problem with that before. And I like the idea of just making an announcement like that, yeah. Just being really open about it. I've had times when I've almost walked out of the classroom, but I think that could have been avoided if I had just been more straightforward in the beginning and said, look, I'm leaving when class is over. If I don't have your test, then it gets a zero.
Yeah, absolutely. And you have to do that. And speaking of, you know, that type of boundary, I've become very strict with my due dates. And I know in the past, it just made me miserable if I would let students turn things in late or, you know, give me half now, half later. It just really kind of made me miserable because, of course, when they would give me the paper, they wouldn't label what it was, or they would send it via email. And I'm not great at organizing my email. So, I mean, I have literally like 19,000 emails in my Yahoo account. So, you know, I prefer not to get an email with homework. So I set some solid due dates. I don't know, 2 years ago, I decided I'm not taking anything late, especially in advanced classes. The first semester I did it, I had 3 students thank me. They said, you know, if you hadn't done that, I would have procrastinated all semester. Who knows if I would have finished everything. I really love this policy. It works for me. Some people, though, a lot of students find it to be very upsetting.
Yeah, I have students who have very good excuses, and it's just, it's hard to kind of decide what excuse is valid and what isn't. And we all have such busy lives. I don't want to kind of say that one person's problem is more important than someone else's. So I also try to be really strict about due dates. And in my class, I usually will accept work late, but will deduct points for it. But I like your idea of just not accepting it late at all. And I feel kind of bad about that, because I know that things do come up, and then at some point you have to make an exception, and then that opens the door for making exceptions for everyone. Yeah. So it's tough, but it's something that I need to get better at.
It is, and I'm not perfect at it. I'll tell you, one of the classes I'm teaching this semester, I had like one student with a 101%, 101%, and then every other student had like a 40%. And if I wouldn't have taken late work at midterm, then most of those students would not make it through the class. And so, you know, this particular class has just been late with just about everything. And so I'm a little bit more flexible in trying to understand why they're so late with everything all the time and trying to help them manage that. But at the same time, I have to maintain my standards and my sanity. So, yeah. So anything you would add to setting boundaries? I mean, I think this is one we could probably like share a million stories about, like, but.
No, I think we're actually going to touch on this a little bit later in another segment, but it's hard not to be drawn into our students' lives, and sort of, we're obviously compassionate people and we want to take their circumstances into consideration, but I think that you know, there's a difference between being a pushover and being compassionate, and that making the boundaries clear from the beginning is the best way to keep sane.
Right. Yeah. Absolutely. Absolutely. All right. So number two, this one is kind of inspired by the blog post balance, and if you're interested in finding that blog, it's stackofmarking.wordpress.com. So you can go there and look for the post balance. It's one of the most recent ones, maybe 3 posts back at this point.
Or you can check on Twitter, because I retweeted it.
That's right, you did.
Jean, or I tweeted it. I don't know, is it retweet or tweet? I'm not sure what I did, but it's on there.
You were the first one to tweet it, right? You didn't like...
Yes.
Okay, so yeah, you tweeted it. But I think the main thing to take away from what you just said is that Jean tweeted.
Can you hear that, Nate? I tweeted.
Jean tweeted, and yeah, and we're all here to tell about it. So anyway, Stack of Marking, talking about balance, and really kind of took a humorous take on, you know, how to remain balanced. But I call this let it go. You know, if you have any children, or at least daughters, you're watching Frozen a million times like I am, and you're singing the song in the car every day, singing it at the grocery store, you're singing it to, you know, as you tuck them into bed at night, you're singing the song Let It Go. I love me some Idina Menzel, but anyway, I'm just gonna let it go. But I have to sometimes let things go with students.
I think that's great advice, because I am a natural born dweller, and I have a hard time letting things go. And if something's bothering me, I have a hard time concentrating on anything else. And so then it becomes an issue of not only am I, you know, still frustrated about whatever happened, but it's distracting me from getting other stuff done. And so then it sort of becomes a domino effect. So definitely, yeah. Definitely, that's good advice.
You have to weigh your priorities, you know, like, okay, so today I printed a test and some, you know, the test It printed like half of a question. It didn't print the whole thing for some reason. And so, yeah, I went back and fixed that. That's obviously
necessary.
Well,
you should have used the copy center, Stephanie.
I know. I should have used the copy center. But anyway. But I'm going to let that go. And basically, you know, I decided, okay, I'm going to fix this. But some things don't need to be fixed or don't need to be perfect. You know, your form that you're creating for your students doesn't have to have like perfect balance. You know, don't keep yourself up late at night trying to, you know, make something better that may or may not add quality to what they're learning.
So I shouldn't have stayed up so late last night adding animations and transitions to my PowerPoint lesson about modal verbs today?
Well, that's a personal choice, Jean.
Well, I regret it.
Yeah, you regret it. So maybe you need to let it go next time.
I should have let it go.
Yeah. Yeah. So that's number two. My number one tip, and this Ba-da-ba. Has gotten me through the semester because I'm telling you, I've been going insane. Sacred time. So when I talk about sacred time, I mean, like, I set aside a time. It's usually Thursday nights, where I do not do anything school related. No planning, no grading. I know that this is my time to just, you know, not worry about school. You know, maybe go get some froyo with a friend, or
maybe celebrate your co-host's birthday.
Yes,
this Thursday.
Which is coming up on Thursday. So that's what I'll be doing.
So
this
glad
Thursday.
That's your night off so
it's
that you can join me.
Time. I know. Otherwise, I'd have to bring those papers with me, Jean. So
that would be a bummer for everyone.
That would be a bummer. So yeah, I set aside Thursday evenings every week, and that's just kind of my time to get caught up on whatever it is that I want to get caught up on. And, you know, I prepare for it. It's not like, oh, well, it's Thursday, I'm not doing anything, and everything is going to get behind because of it. You know, usually Friday afternoons are kind of my, like, big grading time and time to get caught up on anything that needs to be caught up on. So, you know, I plan for it. But at the same time, I really respect the sacred time, and I don't, you know, let things encroach on it. And you know, that for me is what works. So do you have a sacred time?
I would say my sacred time is Friday, Saturday, and Sunday. No, I'm kidding, kind of. Friday is definitely my day where I won't do anything. I get out of class at noon on Fridays, and I will not grade. I will take care of me, run errands, try to see friends. Friday is my day. Unfortunately, I do kind of take it too far and often make Saturday my day also. I've been kind of, this semester has been kind of rough for me accepting that, you know, that my weekend isn't always going to be fun, or that I don't get to relax every day of the weekend, that I'm right. going to have to get some work done. So that's been a battle for me. I have been taking my sacred time a little bit too far. So I think that's something that I could work on, because unfortunately, if you have too much sacred time, then you do get behind, and then you're more stressed out, and then you're not taking care of yourself. So not only is it about, you know, following these tips, but finding a balance, because too much or too little and you're going to have the same result.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Unless too much is having the summer off. Not to rub it in.
Don't want to hear about it.
But that will be a very sacred time for me, I will say. So anyway, I hope you enjoyed these tips. And, you know, if you have your own, you want to tweet to us, please, you know, send us a tweet. We love the interaction. And let us know what you do to stay sane and how you manage. So great.
Paraphrasing and citation, which is a problem that I think we probably all face in one way or another. So let's start off by talking about why this is important.
Sure. So actually, that's one reason, or one way, that I kind of kick off the whole plagiarism, paraphrasing and citation lesson that I do with my students, is kind of get them to talk about, you know, why is it important that we use citations or that we not plagiarize? And, you know, first of all, I think for academic integrity, you know, we want students to leave our classrooms understanding what integrity means and how they can hold on to that integrity as they go through other classes. And I would feel awful if I let somebody go through my class and, you know, not really show them how serious plagiarism is and go on to like an English 101 class or somewhere where they're not as understanding about ESL students and, you know, having them really run into some problems. So that's definitely an important reason to cover these issues.
Definitely. And I know that I could do a much better job teaching MLA format, but I choose to focus on just the fact that you have to give credit and not so much on the technical details. Not that that's not important, because it certainly is, but just the takeaway message I want them to get from it is that you have to give credit. You cannot claim someone else's idea as your own.
Right, because I think if they're at least trying to give credit, then it shows that they understand it's not their work and that you do have to give credit. Even if they stumble along the way, it's a lot easier to forgive that type of mistake than just an outright plagiarism type of mistake. So yeah, another reason it's important is, you know, culturalism in different cultures. You know, plagiarism, that idea doesn't exist. People don't see their ideas as property or something that people own. Or I've heard of even different cultures believing that by plagiarizing, you're actually showing respect to the early source, first source. So,
or that you're being innovative and in including something like that in your own work. I guess that could be considered the mark of a good research paper.
Right. Now, I do have to share a story here about this, because I had one student ages ago who, culturally, she just didn't get the idea of plagiarism. She didn't understand that ideas could be owned, you know, that articles could be owned. And so she really struggled with it. So the first assignment that we did, I had asked her to write a narrative. And in her narrative, it was very clear, it was supposed to be a personal narrative, and it was very clear that it wasn't about her, because things like outer space may have been mentioned, I don't know. And so when I asked her, you know, what happened, where'd you get it? Oh no, my sister wrote this for me. She wrote it and I decided to use it. And I was like, okay, well, you know, your sister's not in the class. And so I tried to explain to her, and we went through some examples of what plagiarism is. And so I thought, okay, you know, next assignment, she's going to get this. And so the next assignment comes up, and what she turns in is a script from a science fiction TV show.
Wow. So this is very clearly not an academic integrity problem, because she was very open about what she was doing. Yeah. She didn't try to hide it. She did not think that she was doing anything wrong. Wow.
Right. When I asked her, you know, so what's up with Mars? What's going on here on Mars? You know, she's like, well, I just really love that TV show. It's not on anymore, but I love that TV show. And I just thought I would turn that in. And I thought, okay. So we talked about then, you know, well, you can't just take things like scripts from TV shows and use them as your own work. It has to be come from your head. And so our next assignment was a professional writing assignment, and they could write either a cover letter or a resume. And so students who I knew hadn't worked, I encouraged them to go with a cover letter rather than the resume. I thought that that would be more productive use of their time. However, she wrote a resume. Lawyer for 5 years, had gone to law school. And so I asked her, I said, so what's going on here? I didn't think that you had been to college before, and I didn't know that there were, you know, that you'd been a lawyer. And she said, oh, I wasn't. You know, my sister's a lawyer.
Wow.
So, I think this is the first time I'm telling you this story. The look on your face is clearly, you know, disbelief. So, you know, I'm telling her, like, with each assignment, you know, this is plagiarism. She ended up failing the class. The next semester, I was walking on campus, and she, like, runs up to me, and she says, so, plagiarism is when you use somebody else's idea without saying that it's that person's idea. And I said, yes, you got it. And she's like, okay, thanks, and, like, ran away. And I was like, okay, finally she got it.
Wow, so, yeah, I wonder what it took for that to click.
I don't know. But, you know, it took a lot of work. And I understood that it was kind of a cultural barrier for her. It was difficult for her to really understand and see ideas or works of writing works or works of art as, you know, property that's owned. And, you know, for her, that was just a big challenge. So,
well, I'm glad she figured that out finally.
Me too.
For me, I think my main goal in teaching about plagiarism and paraphrasing and citation is to make sure that my students are understanding what they're reading, because more often than not, if a student plagiarizes, especially in a journal, like a reading journal, or essay about a book or something like that, I find that it's probably because they didn't understand what they were reading and they couldn't think of another way to say it. And right. So they'll copy or, you know, unintentionally plagiarize, because they are supposed to paraphrase for the assignment and they don't know how else to handle it.
You're totally right. I think it is a great barometer for figuring out, you know, how much they're understanding and able to process what they're reading. And that's why I do like, in a lot of the journals that you and I use, it has, you know, a summary and a paraphrase section and then also kind of an analysis section. So you can kind of see, based on, you know, what type of writing they're doing about what they're reading, how much they're really getting, how much they're having to repeat words. So
definitely. And I think the biggest indication is if it's clearly plagiarized and it doesn't make sense. So
right.
That seems like contradictory, because if it's plagiarized, it would make sense. But what I find is if they're, you know, they're copying words or phrases and then they're putting them together in a way that doesn't make sense, then they're plagiarizing, but it also doesn't make sense and they don't realize it doesn't make sense. And it's because they don't know what it means, what they're writing.
Exactly. Exactly. So, you know, let's talk a little bit about how we teach it. I know for me, I do like to kind of get a little philosophical about it. The levels that I teach are more advanced. And so a lot of times they've had these kind of discussions about either citations or plagiarism. And so it's just kind of to reinforce it, give them a reminder about plagiarism. And so what I will do is I will, you know, say why. Why should we not plagiarize? Why should we cite our sources? Why should we be good paraphrasers? And, you know, I have them come up with the reasons. And one thing that has surprised me here lately is that people really, they want that credibility. That's always like one of the key reasons that students give. They're like, well, I want to seem credible. Like, I did my research and I know who the key players are in terms of, you know, being professionals who speak on this topic. And so that for me was surprising to see so many students talk about that credibility.
Yeah, it's interesting to have a frank conversation with them about their reasons, because when you look at it from that perspective, then it's almost hard to be frustrated with them for plagiarizing, because you can see that it's coming from a good and honest place.
Yeah.
Or that their intentions are in the right place.
Yeah, and I kind of play on their empathy a little too, you know, and I'm like, so can you tell me, you know, how would you feel, or how have you felt if somebody has ever taken something that you've done and passed it off as their own, you know, maybe even a joke on Facebook. It could be something that minor, or it could be, you know, maybe somebody copied off of you, and how did that make you feel? And, you know, students don't like that. You know, a lot of times they're proud of their work. They work hard and they want to be recognized for it, and they don't want somebody else to gain from it. So they kind of get it in that way as well.
That's a great way to look at it. So you look at it from the perspective of credibility and then also credit
yeah.
where credit is due.
Exactly.
So what are some resources that you use when teaching about plagiarism and citation?
Well, for me, I do use, I have actually a few of my classes, we use the Longman book.
So do we.
Yeah. But I really like the Purdue OWL. So I use both of those. I use the Longman book for kind of like practice. And then I use the Purdue OWL website for kind of showing them examples, explanations for how to cite something in text citations or in a works cited page. And so then that way, you know, they become familiar with those rules and they know where to go if they have questions. But we also, we talk about EasyBib as well.
Yeah, I think EasyBib is a great resource because, like I was saying earlier, for me, the technicality of it isn't what's important. It's that they're trying to do it and that they're giving credit and that they are making an effort to cite their sources. So if, you know, if they use EasyBib to create their bibliography or their works cited page, I'm fine with that. I don't think that it's cheating. I think that it's just using a good resource and getting help when needed.
Right. Yeah. I like to give them that resource, you know, and I give them the Purdue OWL in case a book isn't, you know, easily found within EasyBib. Like we had put something in earlier today and it didn't work. And so I do, you know, give them options so that if EasyBib gives them something that seems a little suspect, they can go ahead and check it on their own. I mean, not to at all like put down EasyBib, because let me tell you, it's really a great website. But they do need to be able to check for errors.
And one thing that I do when teaching how to do MLA citation and documentation is I print off the packet that has the guidelines for mm-hmm. print sources versus web sources versus video sources. And I bring in a stack of books, and I put my students in groups, and I give each group a couple of books, and they have to follow the guide together to create the MLA entry for that book. And by working together and using the guide together, then they're kind of getting a feel for how they do it. And like I said, that's what's important to me. Like then if they turn in their bibliography and they have a comma when they should have a period, oh well. You know, at least right. They're getting an idea for how they're supposed to do it and what the process is like.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that's a great activity, and I might have to steal that from you.
Well, the only, I guess the problem with it is that I only use book sources, and so I need to find a way of incorporating other sources into that activity.
Let's bring in some movies.
Yeah, that's a really good idea. Or print off some database articles. Yeah,
I think. Although you'll get them excited, they'll see you come in with a movie.
They'll think it's a movie day. Yeah.
Yeah. That could be a nice cruel joke to play here at the end of the semester.
Yeah.
Yep. Add that to our list of how we stay sane.
Definitely taking care of ourselves by making other people freak out.
Practical jokes. Yeah. Right. Exactly. Exactly.
So one other thing that I do. When I'm teaching paraphrasing is I model it repeatedly. So in my students' reading journals, they have to pick quotes, paraphrase them, and then respond to them. And so for the first couple of journals, I pick quotes, we paraphrase them together in class, and then in small groups, they respond. And then I say, okay, half of that section of your journal is done now. You can turn this in. You just have to do the other ones on your own. So maybe we'll do two together and they do two at home. And so they like it because they see the value in what we did in class and they see that it saved them time at home. So we do a lot of that. And basically how I do it is I'll put the quote up on the smart board and or the projector or whatever it's called. And we'll read it together. I'll ask them if there are any words they don't know, and we'll highlight words that they don't know, and then we'll go to dictionary.com and look up those words and kind of substitute them here and there just to make sure that they understand what the quote is saying. Then I will take the quote down so that they can't see it anymore, and I will call on someone and say, what was the quote about? What did it mean? Just tell me what it meant. Don't try to remember it word for word. And so I'll get a couple people to do that. Then we will paraphrase it. I will type in a Microsoft Word document on the projector so that they can see that I'm literally just writing whatever they said. I'm not looking back at the quote or copying from the quote. I'm going from what they said. So that's how I model it. And if the quote is really long, I'll sometimes break it into sections and I'll highlight a section and say, let's do the yellow section first and then let's do the pink section. And so I find that really helps. And one idea that I had recently that I think that I might try next semester is talking about how paraphrasing is different from translating. Mm. So I think that I would show them a quote and have them translate the quote into their native language. And then we would look at the quote together in English and we would translate it from English to English by replacing words at random with synonyms. So that they'll see that that what they're doing is basically translating. They're replacing one word with another. They're not actually changing the sentence structure, and that's not paraphrasing. So I'm hoping, like I said, I just came up with this idea. I haven't done it yet. So I'm hoping that will help them understand that it's not acceptable to simply replace a few words here and there and then turn it in and say, yep, that's my paraphrase.
Right, right. Well, I want to hear about this, so I hope you report back.
I will. Great. In about a year.
Sounds good. I'll hold you to it. Okay, so tonight, Jean and I would like to introduce a new segment called Culturally Speaking. And this is related a little bit to a couple of the things that we've talked about tonight. One would be the plagiarism and not getting it from a cultural standpoint, but also culturally setting some boundaries with your students in terms of like what's acceptable and whatnot. So, you know, we'd like to kind of alternate this with adjunct antics to kind of address the cultural issues that we see in the classroom and to kind of keep that dialogue going.
Yeah, I think that a lot of what we said when we were talking about drawing boundaries is going to overlap with what we talk about in terms of classroom dynamic and student-teacher relationships and things like that.
Right, right. So one thing, you know, going back, you know, to my relocation days is we used to have a phrase in our department, and I was in the international department, we would say, you don't know what you don't know. And so, you know, it seemed like there were two kinds of people in this world. There were people who got that statement and people who didn't really get it. And we always felt like the people who got it could work where we are. I mean, that was like kind of a key thing when we would interview people, would be to see if they got the whole idea of you don't know what you don't know. And so basically, you know, I approach my classroom kind of in the same way in terms of, you know, the students, they don't know what they don't know. And so part of my job is to anticipate what they may not know they don't know and try to address that. And so I've seen this, you know, work its way in the classroom in several different ways. And, you know, the first thing is, you know, how do they be a student in the United States? I mean, this is definitely something that students can feel a little shaky on because culturally an American classroom is a little bit different than in a lot of other countries.
I think that that's great. So you're not holding them accountable for things, for expectations that you haven't actually set with them yet. So how do you teach them how to be a student in the classroom?
Well, you know, I used to have when I worked at another university, I had a workshop and I called it Cultural Compass, and I would address these types of issues. And there was one specifically on, you know, what the classroom dynamic is like in the United States. And so we would talk about things like group work. You know, in the United States, we have a lot of group work, especially depending on the university where you go. You will work with students as a group. You may even have group projects. And so, you know, where maybe students come from a culture where a lot of the work is independent, that can feel really shaky for them, and they may not understand how to contribute.
Yeah, and it probably seems confusing for them, too, when we're telling them, on the one hand, you can't plagiarize, you can't take someone's ideas as your own, but then we're saying, here, work with this person and present their ideas as your own, in a way.
Yeah, I mean, we're asking them to kind of collaborate in
and
a way
share ideas, share sometimes. Credit.
Yeah, exactly. So that's definitely, you know, one example. Another would be questioning your professor. I mean, that is something that not only is accepted here in the United States, but it's expected. Like, if you have a different point of view, you're supposed to question your professor and you know, see what you can learn by kind of challenging them on that. And, you know, in a lot of countries, that is shows a huge lack of respect. And so, you know, getting students to practice that. I used to work one-on-one with students trying to help them phrase questions in a respectful yet questioning way.
Right. And I think that leads to the next point, how to get students to ask questions so that they're not necessarily questioning you, but let's say they don't understand something and they need to clarify. They need to know that it's okay for them to interrupt or raise their hand and ask that question, and that there is no such thing as a stupid question, even though I think that sometimes there is. but teaching them that it's okay to ask, yeah, and that they should ask. It's, in fact, their responsibility to ask, and that if they don't ask, that they should not be surprised when the teacher assumes that they understand everything.
Exactly. Exactly. And, you know, sometimes this kind of leads into the whole idea of learning styles, too. I mean, here in the United States, we're very cognizant that different students have different learning styles, but, you know, in other cultures, there may just be one way that something is taught. And so getting students used to and comfortable with these other learning styles can be a challenge. And asking questions is a big part of that.
Definitely. So another aspect of you don't know what you don't know is student-teacher relationships, which obviously overlaps somewhat with how to be a student. Because part of being a student is having a relationship with your teacher. So students, some students will want to be your friend and call you by your first name, and others will be more deferential and give you the title. So In fact, for the longest time, I couldn't understand why some of my students were calling me teacher.
Right.
And I thought it was rude, but it's because in so many cultures and languages, teachers do get that title, just like in the United States, we call a doctor, doctor.
Exactly.
So knowing that kind of helps.
Yeah. I mean, and having that conversation with them and saying, you know, this is what you can call me. And then a couple weeks later saying, no, really, you know, this is what you can call me. You know, maybe even explaining the whole thing of calling me, you know, oh, teacher, teacher. You know, how that can kind of sound, because it's not so much that I care. It doesn't offend me. They could call me, you know, just about anything. It's not going to offend me. But when they go to another classroom, I always try to think about the big picture and the long game. And, you know, I want to be able to offer students a little something for when they're out of that cradle of the ESL program. And
that is such a good point, Stephanie, because I actually find it kind of endearing when they call me teacher. Or when they call me Teacher Jean, I really like that. But I hadn't thought about how that could in the future maybe offend someone else.
Yeah. I mean, it's not like I nag them or anything about it. But I do just, you know, kind of I'll make a comment here and there just so that they know it's okay to call somebody what they're asking you to call them. And that's not a problem. Sometimes they call me Dr. Stephanie.
I would be fine
with
that.
I
think I once had a student call me the Dempsey.
Yes.
And I know that because you're the one who told me.
Yes.
When you heard the student refer to me as the Dempsey.
The Dempsey.
I didn't hate it.
I think that's pretty awesome.
I like
actually. It. So, yeah. So, yeah, I mean, we definitely are kind of navigating these cultural waters in terms of how we're, you know, how the students are addressing us. But also, you know, those invitations for outside interaction.
Yeah. So having a relationship with your students is a necessity, obviously, in the classroom. But what about outside the classroom? I think different people have different ideas about what's acceptable. I personally wasn't okay with my students friending me on Facebook. I actually left Facebook, which is probably why I'm so technologically behind everyone else these days.
Don't blame the students, Jean.
I am blaming the students.
Don't blame the students.
I am back on Facebook, though, and it's changed a lot. It's overwhelming, but that was something I had a problem with. I didn't want students, and this was, I think, like my first semester there, and I had students. I mean, I still have students who are older than me, but I think, you know, being a younger teacher and looking younger than I am, sometimes I think it makes students feel like I'm their peer, and I'm not.
Yeah, I can definitely see that, and I mean, for me, I'm okay with the Facebook friending, usually if it's like at the end of the semester or when they're no longer in my class.
Totally.
That I'm cool with. And I have a few students that I'm friends with on Facebook, and, you know, that's fine. I mean, they don't really do much with it. I mean, sometimes they'll like a picture I have or something, but it's never really too weird or anything. For me, though, you know, sometimes I have difficulty with students, you know, wanting to get together a lot outside of the classroom. I had, you know, one student who, he was just very persistent about, like, I really want to see you on the weekend. I really want us to get together. And I'm like, no, I can't really do that. Like, why don't you make an appointment with me, or, you know, come see me during these hours? And so you do have to kind of set boundaries in that way.
And I've had students invite me to their homes, and that's another tricky one, because you don't want to offend them. They are, I mean, that's a huge gesture to invite someone into your home and prepare a meal for them. And, you know, to show someone where you live and your family, that's a really big deal. So I don't want to hurt someone's feelings and say no. And so I have accepted invitations. And then I felt kind of funny about it later. Like, maybe I should have declined, and waited until the semester was over. But I just kind of take it case by case. And the other thing is, if someone invites me to have, you know, dinner at their home or something, I think that that's fine. But then if it becomes like a recurring thing, which it did in one case where they were inviting me repeatedly, and it was really flattering, and I wanted to let them know that I could be their friend since the semester was over. But that at the same time, like, if I maintained that level of friendship with every student that I've ever had, like, I would have no time for myself.
Right.
Not that I do anyway, but yeah. That you know, I'm there for them. I want to advocate for them, and we can be quote unquote friends. But that we're not going to be like hanging out every weekend. That's not realistic.
No. And there are students that I have become friends with, but I think that there has to be more there than just the student teacher relationship. You know, you have to have some common interests, or, you know, things to talk about that you would be friends if you maybe met at a party instead of, you know, in the classroom.
Yeah, that's true. I think I've had students or I've had students from previous classes get together all together. So maybe a year later, I'll send out an email to all of them and say, let's all get coffee and like see how things are going now. And I don't want to put it like this, but I'm going to, but it's kind of killing more than one bird with a stone, you know?
Yeah.
That way you're extending the gesture, you're letting them know that you care and that you're there for them and you want to hear how they're doing, but you're seeing them all at once. And so you're not having to try to maintain all these separate relationships.
You're so nice.
I'm a pretty nice person.
You are a nice person. You are. And you know what? This is probably why you get so many presents from your students.
Ah, presents. Presents. Hopefully I'll get a lot of presents on Thursday for my birthday. No, I'm just kidding. But hopefully I will, but not for my students. I think that giving presents, just like offering invitations to have dinner, it's a cultural thing, and you have to be very careful when navigating these situations, because if you refuse a present that was a small gesture, then you could end up doing more harm than good. You're, you know, maybe hurting their feelings by refusing, and especially if it's really something very small.
Right. Right. Yeah. I mean, I think sometimes they're very thankful for the help that you've given them or the kindness that you've given them, and they want to kind of, you know, show some respect. And even in some cultures, they, you know, would give a teacher a present, and that would be perfectly okay. And so, you know, yeah, you want to be polite and you don't want to offend them, so you do accept it. But what do you do, Jean, if you get a really big present?
That did happen to me. I got a gift card that had a pretty considerable amount of money on it, and I felt sort of uncomfortable accepting that. And I tried to give it back to the student. And it just got a little bit uncomfortable. I ended up giving it to another teacher who had this student in class, and she gave the card back to him and was just like, you know, that was really nice that you did that, but she can't accept it. You have to understand that from the perspective of her job, she's not allowed to take something, you know, this significant.
And,
so yeah, that was kind of an awkward situation that ended up being resolved just fine, I think.
Yeah. Yeah. I think the most, I don't know how to put it, I guess, extravagant gift that I received was a watch. And I felt bad because I couldn't give it back. You know, the student had gone through a lot with his family, and I had been kind of flexible. And he told me, you know, I want you to take this because I really appreciate your kindness and your flexibility at this difficult time for me. you know, and then I never saw him again because it was at the end of the semester and I hadn't opened it in front of him. So I didn't know how extravagant it was. And so I felt awful. And then it turns out that he had gone back to his home country. And so I am not really sure how to get him this watch back. So, you know, I mean, sometimes, yeah, it's hard to balance that, being polite and kind and accepting somebody's gift. But at the same time, not, you know, letting it get to be too much.
But I think that you made a good point too in mentioning how you had gone out of your way to help this student who was going through a rough time. I think that the present should be proportionate to the help that was given. And in the case that I mentioned where the student gave me the gift card, it was really not, in fact, it was not even my student anymore. And it had been a kind of more of a tutoring, like teacher-student relationship where this student would come to the tutoring office. So I just didn't feel like I deserved such an extravagant present from this person who I had really not helped any more than I had helped anyone else. And yeah. I had not gone out of my way for this student in any way. So.
Well, and that's the thing. I think a lot of times we would have done this for anybody going through a challenging time or something like that, you know, where I would have helped anybody in that situation because I know what it's like. You know, I tell my students, you know, I know my class isn't the only thing you have going on. A lot of you have jobs and families and other things that happen. And, you know, I can be flexible with that type of thing. But yeah, I mean, sometimes it's hard to kind of draw the line. So anyway, what about you guys? What type of situations have you encountered in terms of your students not knowing what they don't know? We'd like to hear from you.
Yes, please share with us, email us, Facebook us. I'm on Facebook now, so I'm all about it.
Yeah.
Let us know what's happened to you and how you've handled it.
Yes, we'd love to hear it. And so if you're not familiar with our Twitter account, we're at The Minimal Pair. And you can also find us, as Jean said, on Facebook, or you can email us at theminimalpair@gmail.com. And so we would love to hear from you. But before we go, I'd like to give a couple of shout outs. We have somebody who, and I didn't know what the hashtag FF was, and I don't know if I still don't know, but.
You don't know what you don't know, Stephanie.
I don't know what I don't know. And so, but I think hashtag FF is Follow Friday. I don't know, but it happened on a Friday and he was telling people to follow me. So, anyway, Brad Bottenheimer, and I really hope I said that correctly, on Twitter, he's at Brad ELT. He gave us a hashtag FF saying that, you know, people should listen to The Minimal Pair. And I couldn't agree more, Brad. So thank you so much for, you know, really spreading the word and being a fan. We really appreciate you. Also, I want to give a shout out to a friend of mine, Allison Roba, who's been a faithful listener since the beginning. And, you know, she offers feedback to us. And I'm always appreciative of any kind of feedback because you don't get much because podcast is kind of going one way. So any feedback that anyone has, we greatly appreciate it.
Thanks for listening, everyone.
Yes. So until next time, keep it minimal.